Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about how a therapist can manage their reactions when a client has an amazing breakthrough. Then I'm also going to talk about how we can fight feelings of hopelessness, ways that we can more easily talk to a therapist of the opposite sex about sensitive topics. And then I'll dive into why it can be hard for many of us to feel and process our emotions, how to deal with attachment in therapy, and why so many of us can have variations within our attachment styles, essentially why our attachment styles can differ so much from person to person. Without further ado, let's jump into this first question. This question says, "Hi, Katie, I'm interested to know when a client who struggles to show emotions starts to get upset, angry, emotional, etc. Do you internally but not visibly celebrate?" Yes. "A lot of people, including myself, hate seeing someone upset, although I'd never try to stop them from expressing what they're feeling. I'm just curious because although it's not nice to feel these emotions, we know from watching you that it's unhealthy to suppress them. So when they do start to show emotions, do you see it as a small breakthrough? I guess it sounds weird to say internally celebrate, but I suppose part of therapy is exploring these emotions. So for someone who struggles to show their feelings, this must be like a milestone. I don't know." I love this question. And yes, we silently or internally celebrate all the time, because celebrations and therapy aren't necessarily things that feel good or that would in our regular life make us excited or joyful. It's not always about that. I am excited or pleased or happy for my patient knowing that they are now able to do something that's going to help them so much in their life, like feel the emotions, right? And if I'm working with a patient who feels like they can't and everything's very blunted and we can't even cry and we don't even know where things are, we're feeling them in our bodies, we can feel very kind of numbed out. When they start to be able to acknowledge those feelings, they most likely are not good feelings, but it's a huge win. And so, yes, as a therapist internally, there's like a little mini Katie that's like, yay, you did it. But in the session, I have to sit with my patient. I have to be able to hold that space. I have to allow for them to do this process, to experience it, even if it's uncomfortable, and I need to be there to support them. And so I don't show it unless the experience is a happy one, because sometimes there's milestones and big breakthroughs for clients where they'll say, oh my God, they'll say something out loud in session. Oh my God, I didn't realize this was connected to that, or I didn't realize this was part of that pattern. And then they'll look at me. And sometimes I've had patients that are like, wow, this changes everything. And I'll be like, I know, like I'm in it with them. And then I can show my excitement, if that's even the right word, or more just like the camaraderie feeling of it. Like, yeah, right? Mind blowing. And I can do that. That's really the only time that we outwardly show it, because this could be really difficult. Even positive movement in therapy doesn't mean it always feels good. And so we don't want to over celebrate, even though we know that this is a huge, huge milestone that you've hit. I hope that makes sense. Now, there was an add-on to this said, recently I cried for the first time in therapy, and it was totally unexpected because I have a lot of repressed emotions. Is it normal to hate myself for crying in therapy? I know she was probably internally happy for me, even though I felt terrible, probably. I'm afraid it will happen again. I think normal is an interesting word. I think it's normal for you because it wasn't expected. You probably don't like doing it. I'll even speak candidly that I don't like crying in front of people. I do it in therapy a lot. I've cried in front of my friends and Sean and my family. It's not my favorite thing. I prefer to cry alone. And I think that's part of just our survival instinct would be my guess, because crying and admitting hurt is a vulnerable space for us to be in. And to do that around people can feel kind of risky, right? Or potentially threatening. And so even though it's not. And so because you haven't cried in therapy before, I'd assume you don't like to cry in therapy. And I would assume there's a lot of shame potentially associated with that. And instead of shying away from it or thinking, oh, I can't cry, and letting this thought process, this hating yourself for doing it, run away, let's instead be curious about that. Meaning, instead of, oh, I hate myself, I should never have cried in therapy, letting those thoughts pick up speed, blah, 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 and spin us out, could we consider why. Why do I hate myself for crying in therapy? People cry in therapy all the time. Is it because, and then we have to, right, curious, not judgmental. Is it because I don't like feeling vulnerable? Have I ever been told in my life that crying made me weak or stupid, or I needed to shut up, or I needed to not make noise? Where do I think this comes from? What do I associate crying with? Do I associate crying with weakness or being too sensitive? Let's be curious about that, because usually when we have a strong emotional reaction, like the hatred, like you said, you hate yourself for crying, it's indicative of something larger going on, right? That's a strong emotional reaction to what I would call a very normal experience in therapy. I cry in therapy almost each and every time. So let's wonder about that. Again, we don't have to be judgmental. We're just hoping to learn more, to find out some of the reasons behind it. And so overall, yes, it's normal to feel like this and to be confused and to kind of hate the experience. But let's bring it up in therapy. Let your therapist know, hey, that I really hated that I did that. And I don't know why. And I don't really know what to do with it or how to move forward. We're not expected to. It's okay to ask those questions. Okay. Now, there was another add on. It said, sometimes I even wonder if my therapist may not try to intentionally recreate or wake up difficult relational situations for me to react instead of stuffing down. I probably am thinking too far away, and I feel ashamed for even thinking something like that because I know that I should trust her. A therapist is not going to ever bring up something or try to recreate difficult situations for you to give you another opportunity to react, but they will most likely call it out in the moment. Like if I have a patient, for instance, and I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but if I have a patient who will describe something really painful and they either laugh, make a joke about it, or are completely like unemotive, numbed out, I will call that out. I'll say it's interesting. Anybody knows that's always code for here comes a truth bomb you may or may not be ready to hear when a therapist says it's interesting. But I'll say something like, it's interesting that when you're talking about something so painful and so difficult, you're laughing or you're smiling or you show no emotional response. What's that like, you know? Or has this always been the way that you were? I might even ask you when you cried last. You know, it can take us down that kind of road. And so no, a therapist will not recreate something painful for you, but they will try to acknowledge and identify when we think you're doing something that is disconnected, that is numbed out. And they'll try to get an in there however they can in the least invasive and painful way. I think the goal in therapy overall is to get us to talk about difficult things without making it worse, right? And so they wouldn't recreate it, but they will draw attention to it. Let's move on to question number two. This question says, hi, Katie, how do you fight hopelessness when it feels like mental health has consumed your life? Even though I'm not at the very bottom anymore, my psychiatrist told me there's a good chance I'll experience severe depression again and again. I've had severe depression on a non-functional level in 2023 and 2014, but I'm improving with medication and back to work at my warehouse job. How do I feel like I'm not doomed to mental illness? First of all, I understand what your psychiatrist is doing, but I don't know why they would say it that way, because you're not doomed. Overall, I like to think of, this is like a reframe, okay? I like to think of mental illness just like physical illness that, and I've given this example before, but growing up, before I had my tonsils out at like the ripe age of like 22, I would get strep throat all the time. For instance, Sean gets bronchitis all the time. Those are our, what I would call like weaknesses, or our body has a propensity for that type of infection, okay? So when I get sick, when I get run down, I almost always get a sore throat. Sean almost always gets a little cough. Doesn't mean I'm gonna get strep throat, but the symptoms are gonna start, okay? Mental illness is no different. If we are more predisposed, or we have a history of depression, for example, then when things get tough in life, when we get stressed out, when our resilience is down, we will have a propensity, meaning more likely to experience symptoms of depression. And it's up to us, just as with our physical health, to notice those early signs and get treatment quickly. Meaning that when I start to feel my throat tickle, I rest, I drink water, and I may try to make an appointment at my doctor or go to the urgent care. Nip it in the bud. When it comes to mental health, you might want to call our psychiatrist and say, hey, I'm feeling a little increased symptoms of depression, maybe it's time we increase my antidepressant, or maybe it's time we add something else on, or maybe I increase my therapy sessions, right? There's a lot of different things we can do. And so I know the original question was like fighting hopelessness, but this is actually just checking facts. Don't let someone's offhand comment about the fact that you'll experience it again and again to make you think that you can't better manage it. I like to empower my patients, not disempower them. And unfortunately, psychiatrists don't always have the best bedside manner. They can say things that are hurtful without realizing it. They can be very dry, very cold, very medical based, versus where I think therapists are more like emotional based. And so my reframe for you is to consider that, sure, I'm more predisposed for depression, and I'm more predisposed for anxiety. So welcome to the club that we hate to be a part of, right? We all have these propensities, these kind of weaknesses within ourselves, something that we've already struggled with, something that we tend to go towards when times get tough. But that doesn't define me. That doesn't mean I'm always going to feel anxious. That doesn't mean you're always going to feel depressed. That doesn't mean that you're going to have severe depression that you cannot manage. Those are two totally different things. You know the signs and symptoms. Instead of thinking that, oh, I'm doomed, I'm going to experience it again and again, oh, fuck, right? Instead of having those types of thoughts, I want to challenge you to think, what would it help to know ahead of time so that I can better manage this? What kinds of signs and symptoms do I need to look out for? What do I experience early on before it gets so severe I can't function and I lose my job or have to go on disability? What are those things so that I can decide then to take action, to do something to make myself feel better, to get more support or more help when I need to maybe take that day off from work so I can go in and see, my doctor, my psychiatrist, whatever. Let's look at it from that point of view, because we all have things that we are more predisposed to struggle with, physical and mental health wise, but that doesn't mean that it has to make our life unlivable. It just means we have to be more aware so that we can do what we need to do to feel better, okay? And I think in general, when we talk about hopelessness, this is the last little piece I want to leave you with, is that hopelessness is like darkness, right? There's nothing to look forward to, nothing in the future, nothing that's exciting. And so we have to, instead of trying to create hope, we have to look for little glimmers. And if you don't know, glimmers is a term that's used online a lot to essentially, they're like small positive things that are happening in our life. It's like the opposite of a trigger, right? So a glimmer is like, oh, somebody opened the door for me, or that person smiled at me. I got up on time. I felt rested. Wow, I never feel rested. Or I'm so grateful I got to make a really yummy sandwich for lunch. Like small little things that go our way. Like I've mentioned before in the past, like hitting all the green lights on your way into work. Those are all opportunities for us to recognize the glimmers in our life, and that will slowly build our hope back, okay? It takes a little bit of practice, a little bit of effort, but trust me when I tell you that it gets better and you're totally worth it, okay? Now let's move on to question number three. It says, Katie, I see a therapist of the opposite gender and some topics are a little sensitive to talk about. Any tips on getting started? Now, there's another add-on to this, but I'm going to read it because they kind of are together. It says, I have a similar concern or question. I see a therapist of the same gender as me, and I find it difficult and uncomfortable to talk about some subjects. She brought up the topic of intimacy, and I was so uncomfortable. I know therapy is a safe place, but how does someone become comfortable with those types of conversations with a newer therapist, or any for that matter? Now, in general, when we're in therapy, there's nothing really that we can't talk about, nothing off limits, nothing that's inappropriate. It's all okay to talk about as long as it's done with the goal of better understanding oneself. And so, tips to get started for the first piece of this question. When something is sensitive and we're uncomfortable about, let's say it's our sex life or our sexual curiosity, maybe we're questioning our sexuality. We want to start, I believe, first on our own journaling about it. And I think a lot of you might be like, but they're asking about therapy specifically. Yes, but a lot of the therapy stuff happens outside of therapy in between sessions. And I really encourage you to start journaling about what your thoughts are, what you're worried about, what comes up for you, because we have to be okay with it at least 10% to be able to say it. That's what often keeps us frozen, is we've never said those words out loud. We've never actually allowed ourselves to think in that way. or allowed for that conversation to even take place inside our head, let alone outside of our head, right? And so we have to kind of figure it out on our own. Not only does that allow us to become just slightly more comfortable with it, but it also gives us some language to use. Because sometimes when our thoughts are swirling and we're not even sure, let's say we're not sure if it's our sexuality, if we just haven't had a relationship for a while, maybe we're asexual, we're just questioning everything, we're not sure. Then to try to talk about it's going to be hard, and we can feel like, oh, then they don't understand me and I'm not using the right words. And journaling helps clear that up. It helps us make a succinct kind of, communicate succinctly an issue we want to work on, okay? So that's my first step, is to journal. And once we've kind of journaled out things that we're thinking of and maybe our concerns, then I want you to start bringing it up in therapy from the least, triggering or stressful area. Meaning, if it's a sensitive topic, let's say it's our sex life, okay? And we're raised to not really talk about sex, and sex is kind of bad and dirty, we were taught, and it feels, right? Then maybe we bring up a pretend story about a friend. People do this all the time and it's fine. Therapist is not going to be offended. You know, I have this friend that is really questioning their sexuality and I just don't even know how to talk to them about it. I was raised to think this, and then it made me realize that maybe that's something I should work on with you, right? It's kind of an offhanded, through the side door, sneaky way into that conversation. Or you could even do a doorknob confession at the end of one session before you leave. You're like, you know what? I really have a tough time talking about sex. I'm uncomfortable with it, but I feel like I need to. Okay, see you next week. We can do it that way. There's a zillion ways to get some uncomfortable information out in therapy. I've also talked about like writing it down and giving it to your therapist, sending an email ahead of time if they allow for that. I think in general, getting started really lies with us and our work that we have to do outside of therapy, in that like journaling or maybe having conversations with people we're really close with that we feel safe talking about these things to. I think in general, for most people, it isn't comfortable to talk about it. I mean, I had a patient, took forever for him to share that he likes to wear the opposite sex's underwear. And that was something that he wanted to share because he thought it made him weird and was so, you know, out of the blue, felt really bad about it, wasn't sure where it was coming from. So that was something we could explore, but it took him a long time to even share that with me. And so it's okay to take your time. Therapy is supposed to be a safe space, but we can't push ourselves too much too fast, like right away, because we could re-traumatize ourselves, right? We don't want to go too fast, but we do want to slowly make our way into these conversations. And so it's okay to say something like, hey, you know, intimacy, like even if your therapist brings it up, be like, I know I probably need to talk about that, but I'm really uncomfortable right now. It's okay to shut things down like that. And then do your own journaling about it later. What came up for me? Why do I feel like I need to shut down? What kind of beliefs do I have about it? Where is this coming from, right? Curious, not judgmental. That's our way in. And just take your time, because all of us, I mean, I feel like there's tons of topics in therapy, even personally, that are uncomfortable for me and I will try to shy away from. But any good therapist worth their salt's going to keep bringing it back little by little, at a pace that feels okay, challenging you. And if you're doing the work outside of therapy, it will get easier and easier, okay? Moving on to question number 4. This is a repost, and just know, FYI, anybody out there, if you keep asking your question, you're like, mine is not getting picked. Blech. I try to get through as many as I can. Feel free to repost as many times until yours gets hearted. Once it's been hearted, that means that I've added it to my list and I have recorded it. I am usually about 2 weeks ahead, so it may take a minute for you to see your answer, but just know that it will get answered, okay? This is, hey, Katie, after therapy sessions, I often struggle for days, unable to fully feel or let go of emotions. I intellectualize a lot, but I also have a constant feeling that there's something I've missed sharing. Sounds like you're really self-critical. Why is it so hard for some of us to just feel and process emotions? Also, do therapists get frustrated when clients reach out outside of sessions but struggle to express themselves during sessions? I feel like I need too much support. Look at all this judgment. So I often end up suffering in silence. For some background, I've been seeing my therapist weekly for a while. They're great, but I have a lot of childhood trauma, including emotional and physical abuse, sexual abuse, and bullying. I find it hard to share in person, so I email or text my therapist as things come up. However, I fear that anyone I'm fully honest with will abandon me. Look at that interesting belief you have. It takes me days to craft and send these messages as I'm terrified of being misunderstood and ultimately rejected. I've had many people leave me after I've been vulnerable, including a former therapist, reinforcing my belief that I'm too much for anyone to handle. My current therapist has suggested I try specialized therapy, but I worry this means I've failed. It doesn't. We can talk about that. I'm afraid both therapists will share negative opinions about me, and I constantly fear that I'm a burden. I feel the need to apologize frequently and struggle to believe I'm worth anyone's time and attention. How do I break the spiral of not believing I'm worth it? Does it ever get easier, or will it always be a battle to challenge the toxic thoughts I have? I'm on medication, but don't want to always be if I can help it. Thank you for all you do. Your videos are incredibly helpful. Of course, of course. Now, a couple of things. Let's start at the top. Why is it so hard for some of us to just feel and process emotions? And it's interesting that you use the word just, as if that's such an easy thing. It's hard for us to feel and process emotions because most of them are really uncomfortable, and they can be uncomfortable for a huge list of reasons. Number one, they can be uncomfortable because we've never felt them before. Number two, they can be uncomfortable because they feel really strongly. Number three, they can be uncomfortable because people in our lives told us that we were stupid for even feeling them. And that's just off the top of my head. And those are big reasons. In general, I think for most of us, the reason that we struggle is because of that discomfort piece, right? It's just uncomfortable. Feeling feelings and processing them means that we have to like experience life, like coming at us. Nobody wants to do that. Ugh. Why? It's uncomfortable, right? But the reason that we do it is so we can live life to the fullest, so we don't stuff these down and rage later. So we don't have high blood pressure, anxiety, depression, not sleep well, right? We can try to stuff things back, but guess what? They've got nowhere to go. They're going to come out sooner or later. And so we're learning a new way of being, and that takes time. It's hard to feel and process emotions, but we can get better at it. And the one thing that I remind myself and my patients of all the time is that feelings are like waves. And I know we hear this a lot online, but it's very true. They come and go. They don't stay forever. I know a lot of people think like, well, once I start feeling, how am I going to stop? You're not supposed to stop. The feelings will come and go. You're not going to feel overwhelmed all the time. You're not going to feel intense sadness all the time. If you do, let your therapist know, hey, I think I might, you know, my sadness isn't going away. Maybe it's major depressive disorder, right? We have to allow for these feelings to be because they're there for a reason. But it's really hard to do that. So be patient with yourself. Getting to know the feelings in our bodies and what's coming up for us, even if the feeling is like fear and I want to run away, that's still helpful. That's moving in the right direction. So it's really, really hard. And therapists, do not get frustrated when we're dealing with this. And your question about if we get upset when clients reach out outside of sessions, it depends on our like rules or limits and boundaries within therapy. Now, I allow my patients to like email knowing that I'm not going to reply. I always tell them, if you email me, I'm not going to reply, but I will bring it up in session and we'll read it together, which, to be truthful, not many of my patients would email because of that. I think because they didn't like it that way. And then I said they could text me for emergencies or for changes in schedule. And those are my limits. But every therapist is different. And if your therapist is allowing for this, then it must be fine. But you can ask them like, hey, do you mind that I email you? It's really hard for me to talk in session. You can bring that up. That's okay. And the reason your therapist said that you might need someone who's specialized means that you need someone who like truly deeply understands the issue that is bothering you most. Maybe it's a trauma specialist. It sounds like you've had, unfortunately, a lot of abuse in your life. And so we might need to find someone who can really help us work on that. And that could be incredibly beneficial. That's not about failure. That's about essentially, it'd be like going to your regular GP, your main basic doctor. And they're like, ooh, you have an ear infection. I'm going to send you to an ear, nose, and throat specialist. That doesn't mean you failed. They're just trying to get you the right kind of care. And it's no different in therapy. I refer patients out all the time for different things, whether that means they need a higher level of care. I can't offer that. I have to refer you out. I'll give you a referral to an EMDR specialist. I don't offer EMDR. Maybe we need to get you tested for autism spectrum disorder. Whatever it may be, we would get you someone who specializes, who can offer you another vein of assistance because we feel like maybe it's outside of our ability to care. It actually has more to do with us as therapists than it does to do with you at all. It's about our limitations, and it's ethical for us to know our limitations and abide by them and make sure we refer out as needed, okay? And so that's why they're doing that. Let me move on. How do I break the spiral of not believing I'm worth it? That's going to come through your trauma work. I wish I could give you like a short answer or, hey, do this. That's the shame. The feeling that we aren't worth any time and attention, that we shouldn't be taking up space, that and they're going to have negative opinions about me. That's all shame beliefs and thoughts that come out of our trauma, unfortunately. When we're traumatized, especially in our childhood, we grow up thinking something's wrong with us. We think it's something we've done. We have a lot of shame, blame, guilt, and embarrassment about it. And if you don't remember, shame is when we believe something's like inherently wrong with us. We're broken in some way. Guilt is like thinking that we've done something wrong, right? They're different emotions, but they all swirl together, especially when we have a history of trauma. And so as you work through that, that feeling of not being worth it will lessen and we'll be able to change the belief systems that we have about ourselves as we can see our history a little bit more clearly and heal from what happened to us. And I know that's a shitty answer, but unfortunately, that's the way out. I mean, things that you can do at this moment are to challenge those negative self-talk or thoughts or beliefs that you have about yourself. I know it's going to be really hard for you to do that, but you can totally work on it. You can use bridge statements, which are just slightly moving it a little more in the positive direction. So it's like, if I don't think I'm worth it at all and I'm taking up too much space, you know, a bridge statement would be like, I believe that I could get to a place maybe in the future where I don't think like this. Right. And that might even be too positive in and of itself. You might have to say, I still don't think I'm worth it, but I can agree that maybe Katie knows something about that too. Right. Not positive, but not as negative. So we could do that in the moment, but I really feel like that trauma work is what's going to bring you through where this isn't something that you're plagued with each and every day. And then the question, final question of it, does it ever get easier or will it always be a battle to challenge the toxic thoughts I have? It gets easier. But we might need specialized therapy. We might need a trauma specialist. And there was a comment on this that I would love to hear more on intellectualizing versus feeling. What does this look like? Why does it happen? Lately, I've been reading a lot of self-help type books, and I also have noticed how I can't connect with my emotions. Is there a correlation? Yes, I have a video about this actually. I think it's like Feeling Your Feelings. It's a recent one. I think somebody linked it actually. But intellectualizing is a defense mechanism. And it's one that I partake of because you can understand everything about it, but understanding is very different from doing, which is why you think about it, but you don't really feel it. It's like, I could tell you what I know about the feeling of frustration, but if I'm not allowing myself to actually experience it and move through it, then it's not moving anything forward. It's not helping me at all. And this happens because it's protective, because feeling feelings is uncomfortable. And so when we like to be able to explain something or understand it from all angles, but we don't actually allow ourselves to have the personal experience of it, that's how we know it's happening. And I'd encourage you maybe to take a break from self-help type books and start just journaling. That's it. And we don't do any other work other than journaling, because that kind of forces us to get in touch a little bit with our own experience and how we're feeling. And you'll probably find yourself wanting to even journal about, well, I remember reading that this was, I want you to notice when you're doing that, or somebody else told me, or I have read. That's not how you're feeling. I want these to be I statements. I experience it this way. I think that. It'll be hard, but we can get better at it. Okay, let's move on to question number 5. This question says, my question is about attachment problems starting from early life. I have this problem with my therapist that when he posts about his other clients who are similar age to me, he's a lot older than me, and how proud he is of them, I withdraw and leave. Now, I just want to pause there because when I read this, I was like, why is a therapist posting anything about other clients? That is potentially unethical. Could be HIPAA violations. I have questions about it that way, but for the sake of this question, I'm just going to continue to move through it. I think I'm so used to people leaving me for the quote unquote other in any condition that I've been in. Since I was a child, my siblings preferred my cousins visiting us, and my coping way was to live my life independently as they were ignoring me. Oh, we had toxic independence. I'll talk about that. With this therapist, I like him very much. And when I saw his new great client, I withdrew since then. It is stupid, I know, but I know he likes her better because she does things as he says and wants, and I'm different. I also feel very shy to even bring this up with him. So please don't tell me this. Honestly, I don't know what my question is because I have no solution with it. However, I suffer from not seeing him again. Okay, we need to make another appointment. We need to go back. This has more to do with the fact that you feel ignored, you feel left out, you feel like you're unwanted. And I think it's okay to say at some point when you feel comfortable to a therapist, I mean, I know it's okay to say, but I know you don't want to do this, but to say like, hey, when you ever mention or post, whatever you mean by that, but that makes me a little nervous. When you mention other clients doing well, it makes it hard for me to want to connect because I feel like I'm not doing as well. And I compare myself and then I feel like I'm not worthy. And you can relate it like, hey, I think this comes from my childhood. Growing up, my siblings preferred my cousins over me. But that's, I mean, since there's not really a question, I don't really have an answer other than the fact that this is very normal, that because this was your background, this is your past, right? That your siblings preferred your cousins. So you always feel like you're not preferred. That's a false belief you have about yourself based on your history. And in therapy, it feels like it's repeating itself. And so I encourage you to acknowledge this and figure out how you could bring this up with your therapist. Because it actually has nothing to do with your therapist so much as it does to do with you. And the fact that this reminds you of that. And if you don't even want to bring this up, you can say, hey, I want to talk about something that used to happen when I was a kid that I find affects me greatly today. And that is the fact that my siblings used to prefer my cousins to me. And so I almost felt like I was never wanted. I always felt like I was abandoned in many ways. And I find it really difficult in my adult relationships when I think someone is hanging out without me or mentions a relationship with someone else. I feel like that's happening all over again. And I don't like that. That could be another way to bring it up. Sometimes when things are happening in therapy, we as the patient can get embarrassed because we're like, oh, I don't know why I have a crush on them, or I don't know why I think this way, or uncomfortable. But the truth is, if we can connect it to our past, we don't even have to talk about the fact that it's coming up in therapy right away. We can just talk about what we know from our past and that this really bothers us. We can start there. We don't have to bring the therapist into it yet if we're not ready, okay? It's great that you have that insight. We just have to figure out how to talk about it. And the last little piece I want to talk about is toxic independence. This person said that it was their way of coping was to live their life independently. Now, being independent is a great thing. We should feel free to make decisions on our own, when we're of a reasonable age to do so. We should feel like we're confident enough in ourselves and who we are that we can like make choices and make moves and do things. We don't have to always like ask our family or our friends or our partner or spouse about it. You know, there's this certain level of healthy independence, doing things on our own. However, we are social creatures. We are, our nervous system in particular is soothed through connection. We need other people. I know some of us wish we didn't, but we do. And therefore, if we are like, I can't trust anybody. I can only count on me. I do everything myself. I do all projects myself. I don't let anybody else help me. Blah, blah, blah. We've all been there. I have my own issues. I can be that way sometimes. But that usually is born out of the fact that we don't believe that anybody will ever really show up for us, that we can count on them. And this could come out of like having an inconsistent parent, having a spouse that never helped out at all or said they would and didn't and always let us down, right? We can have that kind of inconsistency or people that we can't count on. We have that history. And so we've decided instead of ever potentially putting ourselves in a situation where we can feel that way again, we're just going to withdraw completely. And that's when it becomes toxic independence. It's actually bad for us. It's very isolating and it can be a really hopeless, helpless place. And so I want to encourage you to be aware when you're doing this. And every time you feel like pulling away, if it's a safe enough relationship, I encourage you instead to step into it. So if somebody offers help and you're like, normally you'd be like, no, I got it. Be like, yeah, that would be help. That'd be wonderful. Thank you. And I know it's going to feel uncomfortable, but again, our ability to change in life and especially in therapy is contingent upon our capability for sitting in that discomfort. So when we say, yes, you can come help me when we normally would not accept help, what comes up for us? And can we sit in that? Can we allow that feeling to take place? Like I was talking about earlier, the waves, can we allow the wave of that emotion to come in and go out? Okay. It will get better. Hang in there. Okay. You got this. Final question. Question number six is, hi, Katie. I completed your attachment workshop. Wonderful. And it was extremely helpful. Yay. I have some relationships with people where I lean towards anxious attachment and others where I lean towards avoidant. More specifically, anyone who I feel is like a motherly figure, I get more anxiously attached. Interesting. But with my family and friends, I'm avoidant. Would this still be considered disorganized attachment, even though there isn't necessarily a push and pull within each relationship? And it's more just operating in one extreme or the other, depending on who it is. What would cause someone to have such different attachment tendencies in different relationships? This is a piece that I, as I read more about attachment, since I've done that workshop, is something I should add to it. And that is that we can have different attachment with different people because it's all about our history, right? When I talk in the workshop, if you guys haven't checked out any of my workshops, I have them available at katiemorton.com. You can go to the shop. They're all there. But when I was reading about attachment after putting that together, I learned more about the fact that each and every relationship in our life can have different attachment depending on where it came from. So in your case, I would assume, I'm just making some guesses here, that the motherly figures in your life growing up, like your mom, maybe your grandma, aunt, nanny, whoever, were not so consistent. They maybe were there sometimes as super loving and then not. And so this anxious feeling, maybe you felt kind of abandoned, maybe there's a little bit of neglect. So you want to cling tight, that anxiously attached. You're like, huh, I don't want to lose that again, right? That could be where that's coming from. And so when we find a female, a motherly figure in our life, that's what we're used to because we had that past pattern, that past experience, and we're relating our current to that. However, then in other relationships, the disorganized attachment, or no, not disorganized, sorry, with family and friends, you said you're avoidant. That could be more of that maybe toxic independence, feeling like, well, I can't really count on anybody, maybe because like our dad or our siblings never stood up for us, showed up for us. They would say one thing, do another. And so we're like, you know what? I'm better off without them. It can differ depending on kind of what I would call the trigger and the dynamic of the relationship. And what this really tells us is that we do not have a secure attachment, and inner child work could be incredibly helpful for you because we might want to learn a little bit more about why these things feel kind of out of, I wouldn't say it's disorganized, by the way, because it's just different the way we interact with people depending on the dynamics, right? Depending on who they are and how we feel being around them, that triggers just different attachment wounds. And so doing inner child work, doing some of this attachment work will hopefully help guide you into a place of healing, meaning that we can have a conversation or have a realization with younger us about what took place. And you'll probably, as you do this work, see why you're reacting this way to different people. It'll probably be like, oh my God, yes, because of this. And that can allow for some loving conversations with our younger self with the guise of like understanding, compassion, and moving you towards healing. It might mean that you get angry at younger you, or younger you gets angry at older you. Maybe you have to tantrum a little bit. Maybe you're really mad at the people in your life that raised you that weren't consistent. Ugh, right? There can be a lot that comes up, but I promise you that at least diving into that time in your life, remembering if you can, what it was like to be you at that age or around those people, that can really help us better understand why we're experiencing it now. It doesn't mean we have to spend forever in the past. I'm a therapist that does not really believe that we have to spend forever in the past by any means, but the past does dictate our future if we don't first understand it. And so I want you to look back on the history a little bit to understand what little you felt, what things didn't happen for you in the way that you had needed at the time. Let's consider that and see if there are ways to offer that to yourself now. Meaning that, you know, when you need something, you give yourself the time to do it. When you don't feel well, you take yourself to the doctor. You bandage your own wounds. You talk kindly to yourself. You give yourself some loving mothering or fathering messages. I know that's all really hard work, but that's all part of that inner child healing. And I believe that will be your way out of this and these types of reactions. Okay? Thank you all so much for listening and watching. Thank you for sharing this podcast. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Do your homework, and I'll see you next time. Bye.